Through our social channels, we asked our listeners to name some of their favorite episodes, and Bobbi Jean Johnson's story rose to the top. Here is her heartbreaking story, recorded in Atlanta at the Innocence Network Conference in 2019, shortly before her untimely passing away later that year. Bobbi Jean Johnson was given up for adoption at birth and later molested while she was in foster care. She ran away from that horrible situation and tried to survive as a sex worker on the streets of New Orleans. In 1977, an antiquities dealer named Arthur Sampson was found dead at his St. Charles Avenue shop. He had been shot once in the stomach with a .32 caliber bullet and stabbed over 100 times. The store was ransacked and the safe was missing about $2,000. A month after the murder, Bobbi Jean was riding in what she did not know at the time was a stolen car with two men. When they were pulled over by the police for a traffic violation, one of the men stashed a knife and a .32 caliber revolver in Bobbi Jean's purse. At 18 years old, Bobbi Jean Johnson was brought in for a violent interrogation that would change the course of her already tragic and vulnerable life. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today, I have a guest who is one of the most extraordinary people with one of the most insane stories that I've ever heard. And she's also just a beautiful, beautiful person. So Bobbi Jean Johnson, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you.
As I always say, I'm sorry you're here, but I'm glad you're here.
Yeah.
And everyone will find out why. And with her is Kat Forrester, who is the communications director for the Innocence Project of New Orleans, also known as IPNO. And Kat, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So Bobbi Jean was freed from prison 2018 after serving 41 years in prison for a crime she didn't commit. And this case has so many of the hallmarks of the causes of wrongful convictions that, you know, it's almost a clean sweep, so to speak. I mean, there was misconduct, there was a false confession that you were tortured into making. Incompetent defense is not even, that's not even strong enough of a word. And we're going to get into that, all of that. But we're talking about the murder of Arthur Sampson,
yeah,
right? And this is an extremely violent crime. This was a white man who was an antiquities dealer in New Orleans,
yeah,
who was shot and stabbed 100 times. I mean, yeah, that's a vicious, vicious crime. And just to paint a picture for people who are listening, how tall are you?
I'm 5 feet tall.
You're 5 feet tall and you're not a big one.
I wasn't that big at the time. I was like 98 pounds, like, and I wore size zero pants. I could go get my clothes out the children's section.
So the whole thing makes no sense just on a purely physical level. And Mr. Sampson, I mean, nobody deserves to die like he did, but he was a sort of a dicey character anyway, right? He was known for bringing sex workers to his home, which is one of the reasons why the logical suspect would have been this woman who was a sex worker, who was the last person to see him alive.
Yeah, she was the last person he was seen with by anyone.
Right. So usually, you know, we all watch those crime shows on TV. You know, you go down that path, at least take a look. You know, but that's not what happened. What year was this, Bobbi Jean?
1977.
You were an 18-year-old girl,
yeah,
at the time. So what was going on? You were living in New Orleans at the time?
Yeah. And I was like on drugs and stuff.
Right.
So one night we was riding in a car. It was me and two other dudes. We were riding in a car. And the police stopped us for a traffic violation.
Were you driving?
No, I wasn't driving.
Right.
And at the time when the police stopped us, one of the dudes that was in the car with me threw the knife and a gun in my purse. And so when, because I know I didn't have no knife and gun in my purse. So when the police pulled all my stuff out of my purse, he said, oh, we got a knife and a gun. I said, that is not for me. But and they took us to homicide division, and they put us in different rooms and kept questioning us and questioning. And I kept telling them, I don't know nothing about it. I don't even know where this place is at. And I heard of this man. And so one of the dude that put the gun in the knife did make a statement and said, when y'all stopped us, I put that knife and that gun in Bobby Jean's. That's not hers. I did that. And he made a statement. They just ignored the statement.
I mean, Kat, do you think they knew at the time that they had the wrong person, but they just wanted to clean up the case and that was what was really going on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they had a pretty viable suspect and they didn't follow any of the leads in that other suspect's case. And I think that so often, particularly, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, 90s in New Orleans, particularly with Black folks, I think that they, you know, the cops got tunnel vision and, you know, when they found somebody and it seemed easy enough to pin it on that person, you know, even if all the evidence in the world pointed to someone else, so often they just got tunnel vision and focused on one person and, you know, forced their theory of the case to fit to that person.
So they knew that this guy had come forward who admitted that he had, a classy guy, by the way, it's a cop's coming, he's putting his knife and his gun in your purse. Yeah. I mean, that's a hell of a thing. And when you were arrested, and if you're okay even talking about it, I mean, what I've read about the interrogation that you went through, this is like something out of a, you know, a bad movie or out of a torture that you read about in a foreign country or Abu Ghraib, you know, or something like that. But I mean, you went to the police station and what happened?
And then they put us in separate rooms and they kept throwing pictures in front of me and they say, this is him, this is him. I said, well, I've never seen that man before.
The dead guy?
Yeah, the dead man, Arthur Sampson. And then one hit me in my face. He said, no, let's take her to the other room. So when they took me to the other room, they still was asking me. So when I kept saying, I don't know, I can't tell you nothing, I don't know, he said, oh, you're going to know. And he called me a black bee. And he put my hand, got me to the back behind this like wooden chair and put a plastic bag over my head. The chair fell backwards, and they started kicking me in my ribs and all over and hit me. And he kept saying, Black B, yeah, you're going to tell us because we know you know. We know you know. He said, because, let me tell you, he said, ain't number of police officers in this station right here, and we could kill you, and your family would never know nothing about you. So I'm scared to death. And so he said, come on, we're going back in there. But he said, and you're going to put on, and if you don't, you'll get some more. And I was scared to death. I was crying and everything. I had five police officers standing up behind me and one sitting down who had the tape recorder. And he said, now you ready? I said, I don't know. Now he said, he turned the tape off and he said, you're going to repeat what I say.
He turned the tape recorder off?
Yeah, and told me that. So I was so scared. I did everything they was telling me to put on tape. I put on tape. But it was a lie. I did it because I was scared.
Well, yeah, you had a very good reason to be scared. I mean, these
and
people
I was
were
hurting everywhere. And even after the chair fell backwards, they was kicking me in my ribs and everything. It was horrible.
And Jason, I just wanted to say that, like, the world had not been kind to Bobby Jean before this all happened. You know, she'd had a really tough upbringing, and it makes so much sense that she would do anything to kind of survive, right, this brutal police interrogation and beating. Thank you, Bobby Jean. Yeah, I just feel like the world had not been kind to her, had not offered her a lot of hope. And I, you know, I think,
because I was giving away when my mama had me. And I had to go on like that. It was like I was carrying the whole world on my shoulders. So I just got out there and I just wanted somebody to love me and I just wanted to be accepted and stuff. So whatever it took for me to do that, I did it.
Yeah, and she was a young girl, as you keep kind of pointing out, you know, who was doing the best she could with what she had. And then this thing happened to her, right?
Yeah. Then this thing happened. This is, you know, there's been too many of these cases where we've learned that the officers have threatened to kill the person unless they confess. Johnny Hincapié is one, Daniel Villegas in Texas. There's too many of these. And, you know, Johnny says to me, he was on the podcast, and he said, people asked me, why would I confess? And he was 18 like you were. And he says, why wouldn't I confess? He goes, I wanted to live, you know.
That's what I want to do. I wanted to live. I was a young girl.
18, you're really more of a child than a woman. I mean, at that point, you know. I mean, we know that the adolescent brain doesn't fully develop until you're 25. And here you are, not just a young girl, but a little girl, right? 98 pounds, like you said, in a room full of big, tough guys who you would want to think are going to protect you, right? And in fact, they're threatening in a very real way, right? It's not like, it doesn't sound like an empty threat when they're putting a plastic bag over your head and beating you and kicking you. I mean, so I don't think there's any question. And I think it's so important that you're here. And I really appreciate you. I know it's difficult for you. I can see how difficult it is. But it's so important for the public to understand that these false confessions happen for a variety of reasons. Not everybody's tortured, but a lot of people are psychologically coerced, or they're tricked, or they're, you know, confused. So yeah, in your situation, I don't think anyone would probably behave any differently than you did. But then what a difficult thing to live with too, because knowing as you're going to prison for the rest of your life that you are in a certain way responsible because you, you know, you admitted something that you didn't do. But Kat, her confession didn't match the facts of the case anyway.
No, she, I mean, she got a lot of it wrong.
I mean, she didn't get much of it right, actually. And that's also a typical thing in these false confession cases.
After torturing her for hours, the police were able to extract the taped confession that was riddled with inconsistencies. According to that false confession, Bobby Jean and a woman named Kimberly Ligon had met Samson in the French Quarter. Ligon solicited him for sex. Then when he brought them back to his store, and again, back to the false narrative that she created just to make the torture stop, she said Bobby herself shot him once in the chest and once in the head, and then her friend Ligon stabbed him over 100 times. Then they robbed his store and sped off in a stolen Pontiac Grand Prix. Now for the actual facts. Arthur Samson was shot only once, in the stomach. Bobby Jean described Samson as being 20 years younger and a half foot taller than he was. And lastly, the Pontiac Grand Prix would not have made a good getaway car, as it was not stolen until hours after the murder. The man who had stashed the .32 caliber revolver and knife in her purse had made a statement admitting to just that, but that fact was inconvenient to the prosecution's narrative and was therefore hidden from the defense. All of this could have been brought up during trial if Bobby Jean had adequate counsel. However, with no family and no backup whatsoever, Bobby Jean didn't have a chance in hell.
Now you're taken to jail.
Yeah.
How long did you have to wait for your trial?
18 months.
18 months in jail.
Yeah.
And I know how bad that must have been, because jails, I mean, anywhere are terrible, but in New Orleans, it's infamous.
It is, yeah.
Your trial was, it was like a combination of a bad dream and a bad joke.
It was.
Because the people who were supposed to be defending you did nothing of the sort.
Yeah.
And can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can. During my trial, my lawyer wouldn't let me get on the stand and talk in my own defense. He fell asleep through the trial.
Your lawyer was asleep during the trial?
Yeah, he fell asleep during the trial. I had to wake him up. And he didn't do no opening statements.
No opening statements.
No, and no closing statements.
And no closing statements.
And one of the jurors stood up and told the judge, I cannot give Ms. Johnson a fair trial because I had a relationship with this man. The judge said, be seated.
With the victim.
Yeah, and he, now I know because when I was in prison, I took paralegal and I graduated from it. But my lawyer should have called a mistrial when that juror stood up, and he didn't say not a word.
And the judge said, just let's please proceed.
I mean, I've been doing this work for over 25 years, and I've heard a lot of stories. I've never heard that before. I mean, I've heard stories of jurors that had, but I never heard a juror actually stand up and admit to it.
She raised her hand and she said, Your Honor, how can I get this lady a fair trial? Because I had a relationship with Mr. Samson.
And so your lawyer was asleep. You're waking him up. He made no opening statement. He made no closing statement. Mm-hmm. And he didn't object.
To that lady. He didn't call a mistrial.
Didn't call a mistrial.
He made one objection throughout the trial to the admission of a photograph. He asked a total of 8 cross-examination questions, the majority of which dealt with the ballistics of the gun. No opening and no closing, and he presented no case theory. He essentially did nothing except
take a nap and sit there.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't defend you so much as process you, right?
Even when I was in jail. When they appointed him to me, he never came see me. Only time I seen him was at court. And sometimes they would have court dates for me, but he wouldn't be there, so they would postpone it to another day.
Oh, so that's why it took 18 months to get to trial?
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't show up?
He wouldn't show up, yeah.
Did you request a different lawyer? Did you even know that you could request?
I didn't know. I was young and I didn't know.
And you probably, I mean, I would think in that situation.
I knew nothing about the law.
Right. And I would think, again, in that situation that you would be worried if you did request one, then you're going to upset the only guy who's on your side right now.
Yeah.
Did you have any family in the courtroom with you or anything like that?
No.
Nobody, just you all alone?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Took them less than an hour to come back with a guilty verdict.
Yeah.
So when I got to prison, at first I wasn't, because I was angry. I was angry and I was hurt. That's when I started fighting and all this. It didn't matter no more, because I had a life. It was like, well, Bobby Jean, you got a life sentence now. It's nothing you could do. You're going to die in this prison. But then I started praying and praying and praying. And one of the last fight I had, I remember I was in that cell. I just fell to my knees. And I said, God, just take my life. I'm tired of living like this. Take my life and do what you want to do with it. And from that day to this one, I ain't been the same. I grew up. I got more mature. And I did everything I could do. They was offering the GED. So I know I had been out of school a few months and stuff, and I got in this trouble. Because I know I was a smart girl. I hadn't graduated. I dropped out at the 11th grade. And so I took the GED and I passed the GED. They was giving grants out for introduction to business, payroll accounting, and paralegal. First I took the paralegal one and I passed with a 4.0.
4.0?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I studied hard. Oh, I studied hard because I wanted it. And I did everything I could to rehabilitate myself in every kind of way. It was nothing I didn't do positive in jail. Now, I had fights in jail because I was small and they thought I was scared of them, but I wasn't. And I had fights with quite a few people, but I grew and I matured. I did everything I know to do right. I was a law clerk and all this in the prison. When I got into the law library, I started writing to everybody to try to help me. One day, my sister said, just send me all of your papers. I'm a British Innocent Project. And when I sent them all to her, they got them, and they started working on my case immediately. Every 2 weeks, they would be up there to see me. And they'd tell me how the case was going or whatever. And then the day of, I went to court on the 7th. I didn't even know I had a court order the day of. They said, Bobby Jean Johnson, get ready, you got a court trip. I said, a court trip? Y'all have never taken me back to court. So I didn't know what was going on. So I said, okay. And when I got dressed, they brought me to the courthouse, and all them was in the courtroom for me.
All the lawyers?
Yes. But all my lawyers walked up with me to the podium when I had to do the plea and everything.
For many long years, both the Promise of Justice Initiative and the Innocence Project of New Orleans worked tirelessly on Bobby Jean's case, investigating leads, studying the evidence, and identifying the inconsistencies in her violently coerced false confession to eventually force the district attorney's office to offer a plea deal. The deal was this: her first-degree murder conviction and life sentence would be vacated, but Bobby Jean had to plead guilty to manslaughter and armed robbery in order to be resentenced to time served. Her attorneys also had to drop any claims that the DA's office did not turn over exculpatory evidence. This was not the outcome that they or anyone who cared about Bobby Jean had hoped for, but it was the only one that would set her free.
It's really sort of the last miserable aspect of this case is the fact that even after all these years, and even after it's been proven that you had nothing to do with this, they still wouldn't admit their mistake, right?
No.
Because they wanted to maintain the conviction. They wanted to make sure you didn't get anything for it.
Yeah.
So the DA's office in New Orleans forced you to take a plea.
Yeah.
Just to sort of...
So I could be free. That's the only way. He said, either you take this plea or you stay in prison.
Right. And I think anybody would do what you did. And Kat, I want you to jump in here anytime, because I know you're intimately familiar with this case, and I know how proud you are of the work that, and as I am, as a supporter of Innocence Project New Orleans, I'm so proud of the work that they did, and I'm so happy. I mean, I saw those pictures when, and I posted on my Instagram, which is at It's Jason Flom, as people know. But I posted the pictures of Bobby Jean walking out of prison that day, and I just, my heart was breaking or floating. I was floating in the air, and it was a whole crazy thing. Can you shine some light on this, Kat? Because this case is bizarre even by our standards.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a case that we worked on for several years. One of the attorneys in our office, Sherelle Arnold, worked on it for a long time, and it ended up being the Promise of Justice Initiative, an incredible organization in New Orleans, who ended up freeing Bobby Jean and walking her out of prison. But we were there because she was, you know, the first female client who we'd really worked on her case for a long time and had a really good lead. And part of that is because, as you know, Jason, I'm sure, you know, women aren't often sentenced to life in prison or long prison sentences, which is what IPNO does, is free innocent life sentence prisoners. And women so often are caught up in things that men do, right? They harm or kill their domestic abusers. And so this was, you know, really exciting for us, I think, because it was the first time that we'd worked with a woman for a number of years. And of course, Bobby Jean is just incredible. And, you know, I think having her come home, I actually came and hung out with her in Atlanta when she got home, and we went to the aquarium and started learning how to use a cell phone, as I think we showed you some pictures. And it was a really incredible moment. I, you know, can't imagine being incarcerated for 41 years.
No, I mean, when you put that in context, you were only 18 at the time. So that's twice as long as you had been alive, plus another 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's impossible, I think, for anybody to comprehend who hasn't been through it. Jesus, who was president when you went to prison?
I don't remember. I don't know.
We have to look that up.
77.
Jimmy Carter was president.
Oh, okay.
That's...
God.
Yeah. I mean...
It's a long time.
Most of the people who are listening to the show weren't born yet. And everything was different. And then you come out into a world where everybody's walking around, typing on their phones, going everywhere. Like, there's just... Everything is different.
When I held my first phone in my hand, I was like, oh my God, Kat. She had to show me everything, how to turn it on and everything.
First thing she wanted was an Instagram account.
Oh, yeah? What is your Instagram account?
I don't know.
She doesn't know. Bobby Jean 2018.
So you walk out. I mean, what a difference. You go in as a scared, brutalized, young 20-year-old woman, by the time, well, 18 when you went to jail,
yeah.
And you come out as an accomplished, mature, 59-year-old woman.
Yeah.
You walk out into a world that looks almost nothing like it did when you went in.
Because New Orleans don't look nothing like it did when I went in.
I mean...
I almost forgot the names of the streets. That's how different it looked to me.
Yeah.
And I had five of my lawyers with me, and it was just, I don't know, it was a feeling I never had before. I used to pray every night, God, you my only witness, and you know I didn't kill nobody. Just open these doors for me and help me. Every night I prayed that in my room. It was so hard for me.
Here we are at the Innocence Network conference. By the way, how about this conference, Bobby?
I love it.
It's amazing,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, so we're here at the Innocence Network conference with about 200 exonerees and 600 people, activists, social workers, civilians who want to get involved. Two of them are in the room with us right now. We have lawyers here. We have experts on everything from, you know, false confessions to you name it. And it's an awesome, awesome thing. I mean, people are connecting and strategizing and coming up with best practices and helping each other. And yeah, I mean, we have 35 new exonerees here that were on stage last night singing and dancing. And it was just some crazy scene, man. It was amazing, including you.
Yeah,
I was. Yeah, I saw you up there.
How'd it feel to be up there, Bobby Jean?
It felt good.
Yeah.
It felt good.
For you to connect with the other exonerees, what does that experience like?
It's just like, because I just thought, I know there ain't that many people that have false convictions, and it made me feel good to know that I wasn't the only one.
Oh, no, hell no.
But I didn't know at the time. But it really felt good, and to know how much love they showed, we showed to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we ain't done yet. We're gonna be loving on you for the rest of time, but especially the next 24 hours that we're all gonna be here together. It's gonna be amazing. And I know that people are so glad that you're here.
It's just amazing.
It's amazing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so honored to be here and be a part of this movement. I will tell anybody who's listening that, I call it selfish altruism, because I consider it a privilege and an honor to get to be around people like yourself, and to be able to make some small difference is, it's the most rewarding thing in my life. I mean, I'm a father, and that's a tremendously important thing to me. But beyond that, it's the most important work that I can imagine being involved with, and you're living proof of it. And here we are celebrating you and celebrating freedom and working on getting the next people out. And so now you're living in Georgia.
Yeah, I live in Georgia.
Decatur.
Yes.
And what gives you joy now? Do you have any joy in your life now?
I have plenty of joy in my life now, because it's like living where I live, I can come and go as I please. Anybody could come get me and like take me wherever they want to take me. Like if they want to take me out there or whatever, I could do it. And they have a lot of activities because of my age. They have a lot of activities for us, and I always attended. They have church service. I always attended, and they treat me good.
And what is it that you do once a month, Bobby Jean?
Oh, I go to Georgia's Innocent Project. I'm a member of the Georgia's Innocent Project, and I never miss a meeting. I'm always there.
Yeah, they've really lovingly taken her into the exoneree meetings that happen once a month there, so she gets to hang out with other wrongfully incarcerated people who live in Georgia.
Yeah.
I see you got the shirt on. Georgia Innocent Project.
They said, Bobby, do you go wear the Georgia Innocent Project shirt? I say, yeah, I don't have one for all IPNO, so I'll wear the Georgia one.
We need to get you a justice shirt.
I know. Yeah. I don't have a justice shirt. I need me one.
I think we can arrange that.
I think so.
Kat, you got that one?
I got it.
Okay, perfect. Teamwork makes the dream work. So this is the part of the show that is my favorite part. Because this is the part of the show where I get to, first of all, I thank you.
You're welcome. I thank you for having me.
Bobby Jean Johnson and Kat Forrester, thank you for coming and sharing, especially you, Bobby, obviously. Bobby Jean, for I know how difficult it is to talk about these things, and it's so important that you're here. Thank you on behalf of me and all my listeners and everybody in the Innocence Network.
You're welcome.
And then this is the part where I get to stop talking, and I turn it over to you two fabulous ladies for final closing thoughts. And I think we should finish with you, Bobby, because I want to hear anything you have to say, anything at all about any subject. But first, Kat, what are your closing thoughts?
I'm just so glad that we helped get her home, and I was thinking about it because we were at the aquarium last night for the Innocence Network dinner, and we went to the aquarium right after she got out, and to see the joy on her face, seeing very cool fish was just unparalleled. And I'm just so glad to have been able to experience that with her and to see, you know, how many new things she gets to explore in this life now that she's a free woman.
Yeah, it was amazing to me because the aquarium, I would always see it. It showed on TV. I used to say, I want to go there. So when Kat had me, she said, you want to go to the aquarium? And when she did it, it was like a light of joy just jumped on my face. I said, yeah, I want to go, Kat. I want to go see him. And when I came seeing it, it was so beautiful. It was so amazing out here. But Kat led me all the way through. And she was there. IPNO has been there for me. I could call them at any given time or whenever. And if it's a problem I have, they'll do their best to fix it. Or if sometimes I used to get depressed and stuff, and I used to call them and talk. And Angelique has been marvelous. Oh, my God, she has been great. She's
our client services specialist.
Yes, she has been great. no matter what. If she can't call me back at the time, she'll text me back and say, I'll call you in a few minutes, just hold on. And but it has been great, and I'm happy to be home. I'm happy, more happy now than I ever been in my life. I never knew so much love and stuff. But now I do. And it's great. It's just that they took a lot away from me. They took everything away from me for nothing. For something I didn't even do. I lost everything. All my youth was gone. And I just want to thank you, Jason, for having me.
Well, we're going to be here for you, too. You have a whole bit new family now. Yeah. You got 800 family members here now, and you got a lot more that are listening to the show. And so you're a brave and strong and amazing woman, and we're going to support you in every way we can. So, again, thank you for being here. Thanks again for listening. I'm going to go try to recover. That's what I'm going to do. And we'll see you next week on Wrongful Conviction.
I have some devastating news to share. Bobby Jean Johnson, who I recorded this amazing, haunting episode with, passed away. It was unexpected. I'm no doctor, but I can say that she died of the abuse and neglect that she suffered at the hands of the state of Louisiana during her 41 years of wrongful incarceration. Bobby was an angel on earth. She was just a beautiful, damaged soul who wanted nothing but to be loved and to help others. And she was out less than 18 months when she died. And I bring that up because it's a sort of a hidden and horrible truth. I don't know the statistics nationally, but in the state of Louisiana, approximately 20% of exonerees die within 18 months of their release from prison. It's really hard for me to process this one. We were planning Bobby's birthday party when we got the news. She had called me and said that, she called me Mr. J. She called me, she says, Mr. J, she goes, my birthday's coming up. And she said, in her little voice, because, you know, she's only about 90-something pounds. And she said, I've never had a happy birthday. And, you know, that really just messed my head up, as you can imagine. So we began planning. Myself, Stacy Ryan, who mentored her, Hero the Band, a wonderful rock and roll band that I work with from Atlanta. We all were putting our resources together and planning a big, beautiful birthday celebration for her in Atlanta. And, just a week before it was supposed to happen, we got the news that she was gone. So, Bobby Jean, you're gone, but never forgotten. Rest in power.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.